And that talk's been kind of floating around in my files for 3 or 4 years now. I came down here to give that talk, and what happened was we had a discussion instead, and that talk was never given. And now I've lost the talk. Which is probably just as well. But I wanted to say some things about peace and nonviolence. I think it's a very important topic. But in thinking about how the last time I really wanted to talk about this subject was during the Persian Gulf. And it's often with many, many subjects like this, we only really address them when they really kind of come to a head, when they really become kind of a crisis. And that's where we're willing to look at these kind of issues. But that when things aren't a hot issue, but they're simmering in the back burner or the roots are being planted for the future, we don't often look at them very carefully. And so the questions of war and nonviolence, need to be addressed and thought about, because the roots for the next war are happening right now. And if we just simply wait until the next war, it's not going to be serve us very well. So I think it's important for people who do mindfulness practice, and this is more of an opinion, I guess, but I think it's important for anybody who's involved in spiritual practice to reflect on things like war and violence, nonviolence and peace. Because that whole, I think religious life, spiritual life, I think is very intimately tied up with these kind of issues. Whether you see it as being actively kind of in the external world, interested in violence or peace or nonviolence in the external world, or in the internal world, that's up to you. But the religious world, religious life and practice is concerned with these things, inner and outer. And I have a sense that spiritual peace or inner peace is not very highly valued in our culture. And I think many times it's very easy, or people tend to see inner peace or spiritual peace as being something passive. Or uncreative, or perhaps detached from life, and therefore maybe either self-indulgent or not interesting or somehow not particularly valued. But the contrast to that, and what often is valued in our culture, are things like production and status and power, control, a very kind of active, fast mode. I was listening on the radio coming down here, and they were talking about the radio announcer was talking about the Christmas season when everybody's running around frantically trying to get their shopping done. It's, for many people, it's not a very peaceful time in the preparation for it. So I think it's very easy for people to look at inner peace or spiritual peace as being something passive and undervalue it. But in my understanding, in my experience of it, inner peace is actually a very powerful inner state. That can be a great motivator for action in the world and can be a great source of creativity, of creative action in the world. That it's a very strong, it's a tangible sense. It's like an emotion, a very powerful emotion in its own right. It's not simply the absence of a lot of things, but it can be emotion that can take a person over, in a sense. And I think that to be sensitive to what is valued and not valued in our culture is useful. To be sensitive to the horrors around us, to the war and the destruction and the violence, to be sensitive to it is something which is not very highly valued in our culture, I think. In part, it's self-defense, because there's so much of it everywhere we turn, just on television and shows and movies, that anybody who's really sensitive to it is going to be left behind or overlooked. And what I mean by that is, I want to read, and I think, I don't know if it was a column or editorial that was in the Village Voice in New York by Ann Patchett. My problem with movies where people get killed is my concentration is broken with the first death. I lack the mental dexterity required to simultaneously mourn and continue to follow a plot line, and so I simply lose the plot. It doesn't matter if it's the star or an extra shot in a crowd scene. I can never distinguish in my heart the difference. So I've fallen behind trying to figure out what's going on in the Gulf. This is written during the Gulf War. I continue to listen to the news and read the papers. I sit in the theater and know my eyes are on the screen, but I'm not really following the movie anymore because the bit players are starting to get knocked off. When it gets down to one life, the mind achieves a vivid understanding. If I take the deaths in one at a time, I noticed that Marine Lance Corporal Michael E. Linderman, Jr. of Douglas, Oregon, was only 19. And I know what it was like to be 19. And I know what it was like to be 20. I noticed that there wasn't a standard military portrait taken of Marine Private First Class Dion J. Stephenson of Bountiful, Utah. And so they used his prom picture, and you can see the hook on the strap of his bow tie. After you look at these pictures, the war becomes difficult to follow, because to be decent, you have to stop and love them and mourn their passing. And there are getting to be so many of them, it's impossible not to fall behind. Once you start to think about the dead as individuals, it isn't long before you start to think about the living that way as well. I know I should think about what it would be like to march through the sand or listen to the missiles overhead, but again, those things are so far out of my realm of understanding that I am reduced to worrying about them in my own simplistic terms. I wonder how they are sleeping, if they are eating well, and if they feel the weight with which they are missed at home. I wonder what it's like to sit and wait for all that time, because I'm so bad at waiting myself. The most rudimentary concepts of war leave me spinning. I can't grasp the alphabet, and so am unable to form words, sentences, concepts. Because of this, I don't know if this war is right or wrong, though I don't imagine it's completely either one. Even if I could be sure, absolutely positive, one way or the other, I doubt I would feel any better about it. So to be sensitive to the world that goes around us, be sensitive to individual details. Some people would say that, Zen people say about Zen, but I think it's true for all of Buddhism, that Buddhist practice is about attention to the details, attention to the individual events, giving them full respect. There was this anonymous quote in someone's newsletter. We live in a world torn between wanting to listen to the sound of a flower growing and wanting to ignore the sound of the sky falling. By sometimes being sensitive enough to the first process, we acquire the energy necessary to prevent the second. How do we learn to open up and be sensitive and aware and have the energy to stay open to the magnitude of what's happening? Maybe sometimes we have to listen, you know, to the birds and look at the sky and look at the trees. Live very simply. My first real interest in Buddhism, in looking and studying Buddhism, came about when I was in the college dorms during the Vietnam War, and I was up for the draft. So a lot of us, you know, were very concerned about war, and I was always taking an extreme pacifist stance in the dorms. And so being the extreme pacifist, I always had to defend my position. And what I found was that, so I always, you know, was arguing it. At some point I realized that in order to follow through my beliefs, my ideals about pacifism, my pacifist ideals were about active nonviolence. I had to be willing to put my life on the line. I had to be willing to put myself in front of a demonstration or in front of whatever, where maybe my life would be threatened in the act. And when I realized that's what my ideals required of me, I also recognized that I was afraid of dying. And I felt in some ways incapable of putting myself in a situation that my ideals asked of me. And that dissonance, the contrast between my ideals and what I personally can do, troubled me a lot. And for some reason, I don't know where I got it in my head, but I had some sense that Buddhism offered a practice, a way to deal with the fear of death, or deal with the kind of fears that will prevent me from living with, following through my ideals. So my first initial interest in Buddhism had to do with war and pacifism and conflict and how to deal with it and how to be engaged in conflict, not to retreat from it, but how to do it, how to have the ability to do it without fear. So I relate Buddhism and Buddhist practice very much to being peacemakers. And indeed, Buddhism talks a lot about peace, and it talks a lot about non-harming. The word non-violence was more or less coined by Gandhi, or is it English? Maybe, I don't know who coined it, maybe English journalists, based on Gandhi's work and Gandhi's term ahimsa. Ahimsa is an ancient Indian word, and ahimsa means non-harming, and that's the word which has come down to us from not only Buddhism, but from other ancient Indian religions. So Buddhism puts a lot of value on non-harming. The first of the precepts is the precept of non-harming, not to harm or kill anything. And in some ways, all the precepts are about finding ways to live in peace with yourself and with the world around you. And when I was my first retreat in Thailand, there was a young monk that was maybe, I don't know how old he was, 22, who kind of, he was a radiant being, very beautiful person. Felt completely at home in his life as a monk. I had the sense that he would always be a monk. He felt very much at peace with himself. And I think he had been a monk as a novice, as a teenager, from the time he was 12 or something. And I asked him, all these years of being a novice and a monk, what he had attained. This seems like a reasonable question. And his answer surprised me. And the answer I got was, he had attained non-contention. And that was a kind of nice answer. I don't know if non-refutation is his word. I mean, the word I was told was non-contention. He doesn't contend anything. And maybe that lends itself maybe to be too passive, to be non-contentious. But I think that that was a really beautiful thing to have attained. And I want to read this because I like it very much. And for those of you who have heard it many times, you can think of it as being the beginning of a Vipassana liturgy. This is from Thomas Merton, writes in his Asian journal, "The path dips down to the monastery, a wide, quiet hollow surrounded with trees, a low outcrop of rock with a cave out of it, and besides the cave, a big seated Buddha on the left and a reclining Buddha on the right. I am able to approach the Buddhas barefoot and undisturbed, my feet in wet grass, wet sand. Then the silence of the extraordinary faces, the great smiles, huge and yet subtle, filled with every possibility, questioning nothing, knowing everything, rejecting nothing. The peace, not of emotional resignation, but of emptiness, that is seen through every question without trying to discredit anyone or anything, without refutation, without establishing some other argument. For the doctrinaire, the mind that needs well-established positions, such peace, such silence can be frightening. I am knocked over with a rush of relief and thankfulness at the obvious clarity of the figures, the clarity and fluidity of shape and line, the design of the monumental bodies composed into the rock and landscape, figure, rock, and tree. Early Buddhism, earliest strands of Buddhism, talked a lot about the kinds of conflict, interpersonal conflicts that arise when people are doctrinaire, when people stick to a dogma, holding on to views in a very, very solid way. And it wasn't that the Buddha was teaching us not to have views, but he wanted to insist the danger of holding on to views in a dogmatic way, and how that creates conflict in itself. There's a beautiful story of the Buddha when he was visiting, the second time in his life he was visiting his home country after he was enlightened. And the people in his country, or it's more like a tribal republic with small little hill tribes in the Himalayas. Well, what happened was there was a drought. And there was a river running between his home country and the little hill country, hill tribe next to his home country. And they shared the river. And because of the drought, the river was very low. And there wasn't enough water in the river for everybody to water their crops at the same time. There was probably enough water if they just took turns, but they couldn't water a crop at the same time. And they probably planted their seeds at the same time, and so there was this problem about who was going to get the water. So they were arguing about this conflict over water, and they started calling each other names. And such terrible things like, your mother lives in a tree. And this, you know, caused tempers to rise. And so they decided to go to war over this. So they met at a battlefield. And the Buddha heard about this, so he came, visited the battlefield. And probably because of his stature as a religious figure, as a bringer of peace or whatever, they put down their weapons when he approached, and he walked between them and said, "What's going on here?" And they explained that they were fighting over water. It was very important to have water. And then he asked them, "What is more valuable, the blood of a warrior or water?" And they all said, "Oh, but of course, the blood of a warrior is much more valuable than water." And then he said, "Well," and then they decided it wasn't worth fighting over the water. And that's the only time that I know of in the Buddha Sutras where the Buddha actually stopped the war. We actually intervened. And he used an argument which maybe, I don't know exactly what kind of argument you would call it. Maybe a humanistic argument. I wouldn't think necessarily it was a religious argument. But it's possible to argue against war and in favor of nonviolent means of resolving conflict through social, economic, and political justifications. And what I mean by that is that the devastation that results from war is so expensive in so many economic ways that if you do an economic analysis of what it would be like to fight something nonviolently, that it just doesn't make any sense to build the bombs and to bomb and to do all those things. And what I think we need to do as a culture, I feel very strongly as a culture, we need to start learning the skills, the abilities, and the techniques to respond to conflicts through nonviolence. One of the great things that's happened, I think, in the 20th century is, in some ways, the discovery, not simply of nonviolence, because the nonviolence of older religions was mostly a nonviolence of abstention. Of Buddhism, I think of Christianity, was mostly you simply didn't get involved. You didn't fight. You didn't make arms. You didn't sell arms. You stayed away from war. But in the 20th century, for various reasons, and Gandhi Gandhi was the main spokesperson for this, the main example that excited a lot of people, but he wasn't the beginning of this. We've cultivated and developed a whole slew, a whole wide range of very powerful and effective techniques of nonviolent civil disobedience, nonviolent action. And there's been so many examples in this century of situations where it's been so successful at the fraction of the cost of war. And there's many examples. One of the examples I like the most is Czechoslovakia, I think in 1968. It didn't work in the end. It was an example of, maybe you could say, of a failure. But the Czechoslovakians were able to hold off the Russians for months. There are stories of how the Russian soldiers had to be rotated into Czechoslovakia every 4 days. Every 4 days, they had to empty all the soldiers and send in replacements because the soldiers couldn't cope with nonviolent disobedience. Imagine conquering the Russian army. That's conquering the whole army. The whole army had to go home every 4 days and bring another one. It's phenomenal. Wonderful techniques, like they took down all the street signs. The Russians didn't know where they were. You know, completely confused them. They took down the signs on the train stations. So the Russians send in all the. There's one story of the Russians sending in a trainload of radio tracking equipment. To, you know, they track the kind of secret radio transmissions. And they couldn't find a train station to stop at. They just kept going right through. And there's many examples of this, of how effective it can be. And there are many effective examples, and maybe Czechoslovakia and more recently is a good example, the Velvet Revolution, Poland. Vietnam had its own period where nonviolence downed a whole government. And I think that very few of us spend the time, and as a culture, as a country, we spend very little time studying alternatives to war. War is like the war and fighting and conflict and arguing is like the easy solutions, the obvious solution, which our culture has taught us to do. We don't look at the other possibilities. We don't train ourselves in the other possibilities. We don't even take the time to learn that there are such things. And if people raise the question, raise the issue, there are nonviolent means of resolving conflict, then the common response is, but it won't work against Hitler. You take the extreme situation. It doesn't work there. Well, maybe it doesn't work in all situations, but it works very well in some situations. And if we don't know about those situations, if we don't know how to respond, if we haven't studied them and trained in them, what good is it? We can't do anything. We need to prepare ourselves. A lot of three different Buddhist teachers that I know of in the last few months have sent their teenage children to get training in model mugging. You know this model mugging? And in some ways I like it. In some ways it makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable. I like it because in training people how to respond, to defend themselves, and very effectively with their hands, just simply, and how to kick someone in the balls and run away, I think it provides, people who have done it say they get very confident. They get a kind of confidence they didn't have before about their own power and their own ability, so they can walk through situations with more fearlessness and maybe with more responsibility and more. And that confidence maybe protects them even from conflict. So I think maybe it's useful. But what it doesn't do, perhaps, it doesn't. I haven't done these trainings, so I shouldn't speak for it. But what the stories I've heard is it doesn't teach people the skills for nonviolent conflict resolution. And we simply ignore that. We go out and get a gun. We buy guns because that's, you know, we don't learn how to talk. A friend of mine, a priest at the San Francisco Zen Center, was held up at knife point some months ago. And he was standing in a Zen center up in the city, is a very dangerous place, and he was up there on the street being held up. And a friend of his walked by and didn't notice it was a hold up because there were two of them were talking together, the mugger and him. And so later he came into the building at Zen Center and explained what had happened when the guy walked by. He said, well, he held me up and he said he won my wallet. So I told him, I said, well, you can have my money, but you know, he started engaging in a conversation. So, you know, but actually, you know, I need some of this money to get home. And I have, you know, and this has to happen. I understand your situation. I understand that you probably need the money too. And I'll be happy to give you the money, but you have to realize I need some also. So how about if, you know, I have $30 here. How about if I give you the 20 and keep the 10? Something like that. And the guy took the 20. He was happy. So I don't know if that's an example of ideal conflict resolution, but I think it's... He had the skills, the wherewithal, to pull something off, which I think was quite remarkable. And I don't think that comes automatically. For him, probably 20 years of meditation practice, it helped. I've been told, I've read, that Sweden and Switzerland have, to a limited degree, trained some of their civilians in nonviolent disobedience or resistance because it's so effective. In Norway, where I'm kind of from, last time I was living there, you know, I was still a pacifist when I was living there. And so I was kind of current. I read the pacifist newspapers and things. And many Norwegians, Norway, it's obligatory military service, unless you're a conscientious objector. And about 10% of Norwegians are conscientious objectors, in which case you have to go and work in a hospital or old age home, or do something, some kind of social service in the country. And some of the conscientious objectors weren't happy with that, because they felt that they also wanted to contribute to defending the country if the country was attacked, and that back then, this was in 1977, there was, people felt, I have no idea whether it was justified, but a lot of people felt very keenly that Russia could attack Norway. And Russia was constantly probing the air defense of Norway. And Norway had to send up their planes and chase the Russians back. And the submarines would come and get grounded in Norwegian fjords. So Norwegians were slightly wary of the Russians. But the pacifists said, it's not good enough to send us to the hospitals to work in the hospitals. We want to have a special training where we can be trained in how to respond nonviolently. And I don't think anything really ever happened, but that seemed like a great idea. That there should be maybe three options, or maybe two options. The Seventh-day Adventists should all go and get nonviolent training rather than spending their 3 years in jail, as you do in some countries. So because we don't know the alternatives to fighting and conflict and war, to hostility, I think we're, as individuals, as a society, as a country, we're too easily swept up in hysteria that comes around war and the collective hysteria. So while there are economic or common sense reasons for exploring, at least, and training in nonviolent strategies of preferring peace and nonviolence over fighting and war and harming, there are also religious reasons. There's a whole religious logic or spiritual reasons. And you don't have to resort to these, I think, anymore in order to justify nonviolence. But for religious people or spiritual people, they often feel that that's justification enough. And people who are very spiritual, some people will insist on being nonviolent, like the Quakers, I think, here, because of their religious reasons, not because it makes good economic sense. And all major religions have, at one time or other, as far as I know, placed peace and nonviolence at close to the center of what they are teaching. You know, in Christianity, peace is considered to be the final goal of the Christian path or whatever, in that the final goal of Christianity, perhaps, is the peace of eternity, or the eternity of peace, is heaven. And it's characterized as being peace, a peaceful place. Buddhism talks a lot about nirvana, and if it describes nirvana, one of the common descriptions is its experience, or a state of peace. I like the Jains. The Jains were the ones who basically kind of introduced the concept of nonviolence to Buddhism. And the Jains, in their temples to this day in India, in some of the temples in India, they have both in probably Sanskrit, I don't know what language they speak, and in English, they have outside on the kind of engraved on the door or whatever, that nonviolence is the highest religion. Isn't that quite something, that for a religion to say that nonviolence is the highest religion? And back to Christianity, early Christianity was known for its pacifism. For its passive stance. Early Christians were not allowed by their religion to harm anybody or to kill. And so as a result, that was one of the main reasons why Christians refused to serve in the Roman army. Because if you're in the army, you have to fight. So they were pacifists. And it's interesting that, and I don't want to necessarily single out Christianity, because this is true for Buddhism and other religions too, but when Christianity... It was no longer kind of a minor kind of outcast group, but Christianity attained secular power through the Emperor Constantine. Nonviolence began to go out the window, was ignored. There's a kind of correlation often with religions. When religions enter the status quo of power, then you start having arguments of just war, and why war is justified. And that in Christianity, I think it's still the smaller groups, the groups that don't have political power, that tend to still be the ones who are the most extreme about the pacifist stance. I mean, no one's going to say the Quakers have much political power. I don't, you know, they have a big impact, but they don't have much. They're kind of a minor movement. But they're very, very well known for their pacifism and their wonderful work in the world for peace. And the religious logic of Christianity, or religious logic of the Quakers at least, is that within each person there's a spark of the divine, is what they say. that within each person there's just a spark of the divine. And that spark of the divine, whether it's a soul or however it's understood, is sacred. And if everybody has the divinity within them, you don't want to kill anybody because you don't want to kill the divinity. You don't want to kill that precious soul. The religious logic of Buddhism is a little bit different because Buddhism doesn't have this essence or this soul in a sense. Buddhism focuses more, I think, maybe it can be said, on integrity. That everybody has personal integrity. But personal integrity is not just simply personal. It has something to do with the way we're interdependent with each other. That personal integrity is something we have with everybody else, that we share with everyone else. Buddhism says that we're not so different from everybody else. And Buddhism talks a lot about seeing yourself in other people. So you don't harm someone because they're just like you. Or you empathize with them very strongly. You don't feel like you're separate from someone else. So you don't harm them because in harming them, you harm yourself. And that's kind of the religious logic of Buddhism. So, you know, this whole issue of no self in Buddhism, which is a big problem in the West. I mean, it's a whole big subject, I think, very interesting subject. But a lot of the confusion arises because the notion of self in the West and in Buddhism is very, very different. So what you find, Westerners complaining about Buddhists who spend a lot of time on retreats, saying that's self-indulgent. Because it's kind of doing something for yourself. Whereas I don't want to be stereotyping, I might be wrong here, but there's a tendency in the West, I think from the Judeo-Christian tradition, to negate this self in favor for humbling the self in favor for being of service to others. You don't take care of yourself in favor of being kind of taking care of others. And maybe that's a beautiful ideal. Buddhism tends to put focus on the self while they talk about no self. You need to learn about yourself, study yourself, work on your own religious practice. And as you find your own peace, then you have some kind of peace to offer the world. And then you realize your interdependence with the world and how you're not separate. And then you start living a life of service from that sense of inseparability, not from a sense of duty or whatever kind of greater calling that people have. That makes sense? So the religious logic of Buddhism has to do with interdependence and understanding that and seeing that. I think that it's St. Paul who said at some point, talked about the peace that passes understanding. Is that right? Or he probably said it in better English. He probably said it, the peace that passeth all understanding. And I like that because all understanding means perhaps also all ability to describe it. And perhaps a place where we can meet, where different religions can meet, is in this kind of peace that's a very tangible and alive and a present experience. And that meeting in this peace, we actually can meet in a certain level of common humanity. So where the religious logic or the doctrines are different doesn't matter so much. If two people who have established themselves in peace meet, what is there to talk about in the realm of doctrine? Does doctrine matter anymore? The peace that passes all understanding. This is a quote from Dag Hammarskjöld. In the point of rest, at the center of our being, we encounter a world where all things are at rest in the same way. Then a tree becomes a mystery, a cloud a revelation, and each person a cosmos of whose riches we can only catch glimpses. The life of simplicity is simple, but it opens to us a book in which we never get beyond the first syllable. This world of peace, the world of stillness, the world, the center point that we can find. I heard today in the radio a report on the Pentecostal movement. Have you heard it also? And the scholar of religion was talking about how one of the reasons why the Pentecostal movement is so successful is rather than offering doctrine or teachings, you have to believe, they offer religious experience. And so I thought, oh, good, that's what we offer too. Okay, I'm going to have to sum up here. Oh, this is maybe a useful point to say. In discussions of Buddhism and war, sometimes you hear people say, well, there's no war. Buddhists never went to war. And that's certainly not true. Buddhists have done terrible wars. But then they say, well, it isn't. That's not true. But no one's ever gone to war in the name of the Buddhism or the Buddha. And that seems to be pretty much true. The Buddhists have come and found kind of religious justification for war, Buddhist justification for war at times. But there's no one said, well, we need to go to war for Buddhism. That seems to be the case. But I think we need to be very careful with this kind of statement. And this is maybe, I don't know if I can explain this, what I have in mind, but because we need to be very careful not to compare Buddhism to other religions. Because if we do that, then we're setting up a situation of conflict or a situation of us-them mentality. Us Buddhists against them who don't have the same kind of approach. And I think that's only to succumb to the violence again, to have that kind of us-them approach. And I think living non-violently or trying to live non-violently, learning to live non-violently, requires of us to live with a certain level of humility or a mutual understanding, and certainly not self-righteousness, because self-righteousness, I think, is also a kind of violence that we have. The Buddha gave a sutra called the Sutra on Non-Conflict. And one of the things he said there was that in trying to establish non-conflict, you have to be very careful with your language, how you speak. And he talked about how it's very important not to overrate things or underrate things. That overrating and underrating leads to conflict. And he talked about the necessity to speaking plainly and straightforwardly. And then I have written down the assertion of self. Self-assertion, perhaps. Maybe this is where we have to be careful with Western language. But self-assertion is a subtle form of violence. And when I thought of that, I thought, you know, the Persian Gulf War, it seemed, when you listen to some of the things being said in America, that some of the reason why we were going to war was because of pride. That American pride, this is a chance to get American pride back after it had been lost in Vietnam. And this kind of self-assertion. And I don't know if that's necessarily the root of the war, but it contributed, I think, to some degree. And that has nothing to do with the conflict. It's completely separate from the conflict. It's 9 o'clock. Can I continue for 5 more minutes or so? Or should we take a 1 minute break? Do people leave or have to go? Or just keep going? See what happens. You can leave, I guess, if you have to. Because I want to tell a story that I heard last night. Someone called me. A friend of mine who was in conflict with a lot of different people. A whole group of people. And they were all, many of them were very angry with him. And he was kind of oblivious that they were even angry, but when he started hearing how angry they were, he was very confused and upset. And he spent a long time reflecting on thinking about this, and he's been a long time meditator. And he told me how he was sitting in meditation. And in his meditation practice, all these scenarios are going through his mind, you know. What this person said, what that person said, and how that person must have seen the situation, and what he probably did or what he didn't do, or maybe how awful he was because of what he maybe had done, or all these scenarios. Until at one point he realized that these were all people's scenarios, all people's stories. And somehow that kind of little realization made all the stories go quiet, he said. He became completely quiet. And then he said from left field came this voice. And the voice said, the situation arose because your heart was closed. And then he realized that he was afraid of those people. And so he closed himself to those people. And most of the conflict that arose, most of the people were angry, arose because he had closed himself to those people. And so at that point, he said, when he saw that, he said, my fear, my being closed, that's kind of like, he said, for me, it's like the automatic nervous system working. It's like who I am. So when he realized that also, he felt he could forgive himself for he saw his responsibility for the conflict, finally. And he forgave himself for it, and he was able to forgive everybody else for being angry with him, which was kind of nice. But what I thought was nice was, he found a level of stillness. And it was in the stillness that somehow the solution arrived. And there's something that's possible through quieting the mind, through stilling the mind through meditation, that other possibilities arise, other things we don't often see, other insights. And that the world of our frantic thoughts, which we often spin in, often is not the best place for conflict resolution. It may be important to think about it and think carefully, but there's a whole other place of creativity we have, which comes out of a place of more being at peace with oneself, or being still or quiet. So this state of being quiet or still or peaceful in itself is a state, I think, of potentially great creativity. And, you know, he said it came from left field. Who knows where it comes from sometimes, some certain kinds of answers. And for him, you know, he saw how all this conflict, most of this conflict for him arose out of his fear. His fear kind of conditioned the situation. And it's often said that a lot of violence and a lot of conflict, a lot of hostility, arises out of fear. I feel a little bit, I shouldn't use the word conflict so often, because that's, conflict itself is not necessarily negative, but hostility and aggression and war comes from fear. And so as we... I think one of the things that we learn to do when we do a spiritual practice, do a mindfulness practice, is we learn to see conflict, whatever kind of conflict it is, as occasions for spiritual growth. That when there are conflicts, of course there's going to be conflicts in people's lives, that can we discover within us, or discover in the situation, avenues or channels of compassion, of understanding, of loving kindness for the situation. Are there other ways of responding with understanding? And sometimes it takes a long time. Sometimes it takes a willingness to stay in there and hang in there and reflect, think, meditate, sit and be quiet, talk to our friends. It takes patience. I think if you want to resolve conflict without getting into a fight, you have to be somewhat patient also. An inner conflict, inner aggression, inner hostility. There's so much of that also. And how much of outer hostility comes out of inner hostility towards ourselves? We beat ourselves up. We berate ourselves. We're critical of ourselves. Can we end all the wars? And I think that's the promise. Maybe I feel a little bit shy to use the word promise, but it's a promise, I think, of Buddhist practice. It's a practice that ends the inner war. I suggest that it ends the outer war also, the war that we have with others. The Buddha said at some point, I'm in conflict with no one. That's a pretty wonderful thing to say. I don't know what exactly he meant, but to walk through the world and be in conflict with no one, I think, is the possibility that Buddhism offers. And with that, I'll end with a poem. Maybe another beginning of a liturgy, because Jack Kornfield likes to read it a lot. So I got it from him. Take the time to pray or meditate. It is the sweet oil that eases the hinge into the garden, so the doorway can swing open easily. You can always go there. Consider yourself blessed. The stones that break your bones will build the altar of your love. Your home is the garden. Carry its odor hidden in you into the city. Suddenly your enemies will buy seed packets and fall to their knees to plant flowers in the dirt by the road. They'll call you friend and honor your passing among them. When asked who was that, they will say, Oh, that one has been beloved by us since before time began. This from people who would have trampled over you to maintain their advantage. Give everything away except your garden, your worry, your fear, your small-mindedness. Your garden can never be taken away from you. So this inner something, maybe today I can call it peace, inner peace. Last week I tried to call it unsupported consciousness, but didn't go over too well, I felt. But today I'll call it peace. You know, this inner something, inner peace that we can all taste, that we can all find, and then we carry it with us. And I've known situations I've been in where I have been ready to, maybe in a minor way, to be in a conflicting relationship with someone, and the person being completely at peace and my conflict melting away. It's been so beautiful to be in that end of it, that it would be nice to be able to give that also, to have that ability. Givers of peace. So please, this is your garden, Monday evenings, Monday evening garden. And I hope you carry the odor with you into this wonderful season of peace. Thank you.